The Leonard Lopate Show really needs your help. We are conducting an anonymous 5-minute survey to learn a bit about you and the podcast that you love. So visit wmyc.podcastingsurvey.com to find it, or click on the link in our show notes or on our show page. We'd really appreciate your help. Knowing more about you helps us put together more of the shows that you enjoy. Again, that's wnyc.podcastingsurvey.com. Thank you from all of us at the Leonard Lopate Show. Richard Haass served in the State Department under President Reagan, on the National Security Council under George H.W. Bush, and again in the State Department during George W. Bush's first term. Since 2003, he has been the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. In his latest book, A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order, Dr. Haass draws on all of his years of experience for an examination of the history of American international relations, what contributed to peace and prosperity for decades after World War II, and what might be leading to a new era of instability. It's published by Penguin. I'm very pleased it has brought Richard Haass back to our show. Hello. Welcome back.
Thank you.
President George H.W. Bush spoke before a joint session of Congress of an emerging new world order on September 11, 1990. It caused quite a stir. Was he right, or maybe not in the sense that he intended?
Well, he was optimistic. This was, after all, after the Berlin Wall had come down. And it was in the context of the world coming together in an unprecedented way to deal with the aggression of Saddam Hussein in Kuwait. And what he was hoping was that we could build on these two developments and essentially have a more cooperative world that could grapple with any regional or global problem. He was, as it turned out, overly optimistic.
Hadn't Woodrow Wilson used that expression after World War I and others at times over the past 100 years?
Well, there's traditionally been a streak of optimism in America's relationship to the world. I think with Wilson, there was a much greater emphasis on what would be going on inside of countries. That was really the whole Wilsonian tradition of American foreign policy. Bush was not someone who spent most of his time, say, talking about how China or Russia organized itself. He was simply emphasizing that he thought the chance for greater cooperation between countries had gone up.
Is the use of the word order anything more than a way of saying stability and predictability?
It's close to that. I think it essentially means that there's agreement on how the world ought to be organized, how the rules ought to be set. And there also, though, is a balance of power, that those who disagree with those rules aren't in a position to change them unilaterally.
What old order did Bush or Wilson imagine was ending? Were they referring to the same order, what you called World Order 1.0?
No, it wasn't that. What Bush was talking about was simply that the Cold War had given way. That was a world that was essentially the United States and Russia were almost the default option was to oppose one another. And he actually thought that what was coming into the being was a world of much greater potential collaboration. When I talk about World Order 1.0, it's simply that this for nearly 300, 400 years, the world has been premised on the notion that sovereignty is the basic rule, that what goes on within any country's borders are its business alone, and we can't change borders by force.
That's the Westphalian system, the Westphalian sovereignty. So is this something that was developed in Westphalia?
Well, it essentially came out of the 30 Years' War that ravaged Europe, and this was an idea that came out, yes, at the Treaty of Westphalia. More important, it was operationalized over the centuries, particularly in Europe.
Do you think that either Bush or Wilson were even thinking about Westphalia?
Look, I don't want my presidents to be professors. I expect not.
It wouldn't hurt sometimes. No. Although Wilson had been head of Princeton.
He had president of Princeton University. But again, what you wanted them to be aware of was the basic operations, rules, principles of international order. And Bush very much was. When Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, one of the reasons he felt so strongly about it was he understood that how the United States and the world reacted to that would set the precedent for what would happen in the next era of history. And he thought that what Saddam did and how he did it was a kind of brutality that could not be tolerated.
If the old order is failing, what needs to be done? You've called one of your chapters World Order 2.0.
Right. It builds on what we were just talking about. I still want a world where countries do not invade one another with impunity. I don't want a world where everybody is intervening in everyone else's business. But, and it's a big but, we live in a world of globalization, and essentially nothing stays local for long. What goes on inside the borders of other countries now can very much affect not just themselves, but others. So if it's computer hackers, if it's terrorists, if it's an outbreak of infectious disease, we can go through a very long list. All I'm trying to say is anything that now takes place inside the territory of another country, if it has adverse implications or consequences for others, it can't simply be their business alone. We now have a stake in how they manage what goes on inside their own territory.
Isn't that the opposite of what the president has been saying about America first?
Well, I have real problems with America first, because it seems to me it overlooks the fact that what goes on out there will and can affect what goes here. It's too narrow a view of America's interests in the world. And a world in which everyone else puts themselves first will be a world, I fear, that will be overwhelmed by global challenges.
Historically, have some values like justice or fairness been traded off in favor of order?
Absolutely. Indeed, it's probably the longest running and most fundamental debate about American foreign policy. You mentioned Woodrow Wilson before. To put it bluntly, how much should the business of American foreign policy be the foreign policy of others to influence that, as opposed to how much should the business of American foreign policy be to transform the nature of others? I lean more towards the realist end, that the purpose of foreign policy should be to influence foreign policy. But obviously others, and both Democrats and Republicans alike, this does not line up along party lines, feel quite differently.
Don't many nations have an enormous stake in what goes on in this country?
Absolutely. We have, as a result, real obligations and responsibilities, whether it's from how we manage the dollar, because that has implications for everyone else, for what it is we do or don't do in the world. The United States, because of the preponderance of its power, we have more influence, more weight than anybody else. And I would argue we need to take that into account.
Do you see a growing need nowadays to pay more attention to issues like human rights, even if they may be at odds with stability?
I think there's always a place for human rights. I wouldn't say there's more. What I think we have to distinguish is between those situations where human rights, say, are abridged, and those situations where it gets so bad that, for example, it causes the kind of massive refugee flows that we're seeing coming out of Syria. And you've also got to ask yourself one other question, Leonard. You've got to ask yourself, given the full range of American interests, say we don't like human rights in China, do we have the ability to meaningfully affect them? And do we have the luxury of even trying, given, say, that we need Chinese help with North Korea? So I don't find the human rights consideration an absolute.
In a New York Times op-ed you wrote 23 years ago with Brent Scowcroft, you identified points of peril in U.S. foreign policy that included North Korea, China, Russia, Ukraine, European security. Is it deja vu all over again?
Absolutely. And it's.
Do we go in cycles here? Like business cycles?
Well, they're actually, interestingly enough, whether it was Arthur Schlesinger Jr. talking about the cycles of American history, you've had various people in the world talk about cycles of international order and disorder. One of my colleagues, Steve Sestanovich, recently wrote a book about the cycles of American presidents. We go from presidents who are great, characterized by great exertion, say George W. Bush, and those who are characterized more by retrenchment, Barack Obama. So I do think there is something to cycles.
Wasn't the first half of the 20th century the most violent in human history?
Absolutely.
So could we see some comparable violence again?
I don't think we're going to see anything on the scale of that kind of concentrated violence where you have, for example, a Nazi Germany, an Imperial Japan. I'm much more worried about a decentralized violence, if that makes any sense, where you have a North Korea or an Iran or an ISIS or an Al-Qaeda or simply weak or failed states or climate change. What worries me about this era of history, and that's what it's one of the ways it's fundamentally different than so much of modern history, is it's not some rising, cranky, great power. What's so different in the threats about this era is it's this panoply of things from strong states to weak states to global issues we can't contend with. And the risk is the inbox gets overwhelmed.
I'm speaking with Richard Haass. His latest book, A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order, it's published by Penguin Press. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So there are cycles and eras of instability?
Sure, but what worries me is that the current era is one roughly of 25 years now since the Cold War ended, and the trend, the arrows, are going in the wrong direction. And again, it's a different kind of instability. That's what's so uncharacteristic.
So what can be done to build or revise a new international system? For most part, aren't major powers far less willing to risk using military coercive force now?
well, not all. Russia, for example, isn't one that seems to be terribly reluctant to use military force. We use it every day. I think what we are reluctant to do is to do large-scale Iraq-style, Afghan-style interventions. But the United States right now is probably using armed force in one way or another in dozens of countries on a daily basis.
But we also have tried sanctions. Are sanctions an effective alternative?
Sanctions can be a useful instrument. They're probably the most overused tool of American foreign policy. We ask them to do a lot. We ask them to do too much. And there's very little in the history of sanctions that suggests they can accomplish big things in short amounts of time.
Weren't the League of Nations and later the UN attempts to replace coercive tactics with democratic and diplomatic approaches?
Sure, but they were based upon a premise that didn't exist. We began this conversation talking about consensus and legitimacy and ideas of order. And the problem with things like the UN or the League of Nations is there's not a shared sense of how the world ought to be operated. And you have outliers who will essentially work against what it is they want to do.
Do diplomats do politically what business leaders do economically when they consult with foreign officials, establish ties, resolve smaller matters behind the scenes and so on?
Well, that's essentially the stuff of diplomacy and statecraft. So it's sometimes what it is they agree to disagree about, what it is they agree to work on. I mean, take the recent meeting in Mar-a-Lago between Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, and Donald Trump. What you had was an agreement not, for example, to make trade disputes a real issue. The United States had already decided that it wasn't going to press China about Taiwan and reintroduce questions about whether there's only one China. Instead, I think there was a tacit agreement that the focus for the next phase of U.S.-Chinese relations would be on North Korea. So, yes, if diplomacy can make a real difference.
Didn't candidate Trump say that he would invite Kim Jong-un to the White House and negotiate over hamburgers? That was in the same speech, by the way, at a rally where he said that NATO was obsolete.
Well, you know, the good news is on NATO is he's come to see NATO as anything but obsolete in an era of renewed Russian pressure. In terms of Kim Jong-un, hamburgers at the White House seems a bit much, but I, for one, would not oppose. Indeed, under the right terms, I would welcome a direct negotiation between the United States and North Korea over the North Korean missile and nuclear programs. Indeed, my own guess is if there is any chance of resolving or at least stabilizing this issue on a basis we could live with, it may have to come through direct talks.
Is it a problem when the president doesn't understand what NATO does?
Well, again, I think... You know,
on the job?
I don't know if it's a problem. It's a reality. And you've got someone who came into this job with precious little background. He had no background in government. He had no real knowledge of most issues in foreign policy. And yes, you've got on-the-job training. You've got on-the-job learning. What you just hope is that it takes hold sufficiently and soon enough that he can be an effective commander-in-chief.
Are new technologies providing new tools and new means of disruption, like cyber warfare and financial tools and possible automated systems?
Cyber in particular. This is a whole new domain, and this is an area where the technology has so outpaced and outstripped our ability to regulate it that we're playing catch-up and we're losing the race. More broadly, you've had a dissemination of capability and technologies around the world. One of the reasons I use the word disarray in this book, in the title, is we have now so much decentralized capacity. The spread of technology has given a lot of players the ability to disrupt.
But there's other kinds of disarray. Brexit, other nationalist and populist movements are signaling another kind of shift distinct from the rise of the non-state actors who have been so much concern. Marie Le Pen is now promising to free France from the EU following England.
You're right. There's populism, there's nationalism. What's going on in Europe is, to me, was really unexpected. I can't remember the last time you and I had a conversation, but disarray in Europe would not have even been on the agenda. Europe was the most stable, placid part of the world. So here we are.
Because we relied on Angela Merkel to keep the whole thing together.
But also a consensus. And what's frightening is that Europe, you know, as you talked about before, the first half of the 20th century, Europe was the venue of two extraordinarily violent, destructive world wars. You had World War II. In the aftermath of World War II, you had what? The creation of NATO and the creation, what ultimately led to the European Union, began as the coal and steel community.
And the UN.
And, you know, but even I'm talking about European order. The two principal foundations of European order were NATO and this European project. Suddenly, you have people contesting for power or in power in Europe who are questioning the fundamental pillars of what has made Europe peaceful and prosperous to an unprecedented, almost ahistorical degree. That is the sort of thing that ought to worry people, and you're exactly right. One of the big reasons there's disarray in the world right now is you have this rise of populists and nationalists who seem in some ways uninformed by history and willing to take enormous risks.
Is it because economic developments are sometimes lead political ones?
I think the economic argument is weaker than a lot of people think because all things being equal, Europe, again, is quite prosperous. I think in the case more recently, this sudden rise of nationalism and populism probably has more to do with fear of immigration and just a certain frustration about what it might lead to. In this country, all the opposition to immigration, we've seen that, all the opposition to trade. I think what people are doing is scapegoating immigrants and trade, and I think they're ignoring in many cases the real issues. And I bet, you know, you'll have an increasing number of shows on this topic. The right, you mentioned it before, it's robots, it's artificial intelligence, it's driverless vehicles. We are going to see job destruction on a massive scale, and we're not prepared to deal with it.
How important is the rise of ISIS and other non-state actors? Does that suggest that power is being redistributed, that states may no longer have the same kinds of roles that they had in the past?
Absolutely. And so much of history is we worry about strong states. I'm increasingly worried about weak states, states that can't exert authority over their territory. Instead, you have these actors, and these actors have real capacity. They have access to money. They have access to people. They can use the internet. They obviously have the ability to kill and destroy. And we're seeing it not just in the Middle East. We're seeing it in Africa. We're seeing it in Asia and Europe.
So if the system survived both world wars and the upheavals since, why is so much crisis looming now? Or is it looming or is it already underway?
It's already underway. My few big answers would be one is globalization. It's reached a scale now.
Well, isn't globalization a positive thing as well as a negative thing?
It's a neutral thing. It can be positive. It can be negative. Simply the dark side of it, though, is real because a lot of the things that cross border in great numbers with great speed are not benign. They're actually quite threatening. You have all this capacity in lots of hands. You also have the United States playing a very uneven role, both by what we've done, what I would call acts of commission, things like the Iraq War of 2003, things we haven't done, President Obama's refusal to get involved in Syria and so forth. I believe we've exacerbated
things. Wait, did he, or isn't it a bit more complicated? There was pressure from Congress, there were other...
And I don't buy that argument for a second. Presidents, as we've seen since World War II, have had hundreds and hundreds of opportunities or examples where they've used military force without explicit authorization from Congress. President could and should have used military force then. This president used military force in a limited way the other day in Syria. The argument that somehow this president needed Congress to green light the use of force, I thought was an excuse for not using force.
How did the collapse of the Soviet Union affect the order that dominated since World War II?
It's an interesting question. The Cold War had a peculiar order. The United States and the Soviet Union were limited because of their fear of nuclear escalation. There were certain rules that grew up about how far they would press advantage with one or another proxy or ally. When the Cold War ended, a lot of those rules went out the window, and suddenly we went from a world in which you had two centers of real authority and real discipline to a world of multiple centers of capacity and much less discipline.
Did we have much trade with the Soviet Union? I know we sold them a lot of wheat once in a while.
Not a whole lot. There was a hope that a certain degree of economic interaction with them would at least be one of the things on one side of the scale that would lead them to be a less dangerous country, but it was pretty limited.
After the collapse of the USSR, did the United States miss an opportunity to use its power more effectively, at least on some issues like climate change or peace in the Middle East?
Well, two things. I think there'll be one set of debates on whether the United States missed an opportunity to better integrate the then Soviet Union, soon to be Russia. What are things we could have done to have someone brought them into the international system more? And I think historians will argue that one for decades to come. More broadly, if you look at the last 25 years, we have had unprecedented primacy. The United States has had structural advantages that are really unprecedented. And I would say for the most part, and I'm sorry to have to say this, I think we've squandered the historical opportunity we had.
It's just been reported that U.S. fighter aircraft have intercepted two Russian bombers in international airspace about 100 miles off the coast of Alaska. Are we looking at a new era of brinkmanship? There have also been ships near Maryland.
Well, there's been some of that. We see it in Europe. We see it in the Middle East. We've seen things like that. What's so worried to me about Mr. Putin's Russia, there's no one there who can tell Mr. Putin not to do something. I thought you and I are old enough to remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. Khrushchev had a Politburo. Khrushchev had constraints, and ultimately he gave way to some of those constraints. Vladimir Putin is the most unconstrained Russian or Soviet leader since Joseph Stalin, and that gives me pause. And yes, he's got one-dimensional power. He can coerce using military force or cyber. So yes, that is one of the factors that makes this a world of disarray and potentially worse.
My guest is Dr. Richard Haass, the president of the Nonpartisan Council on Foreign Relations. His latest book, A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order, published by Penguin Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We are back with Richard Haass, H-A-A-S-S. His latest book, A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order, published by Penguin Press. Is a new balance of power evolving between the United States and China?
I wouldn't say so much it's a new balance. The United States still has primacy. We have advantages. But I think, contrary to history, the United States and China have managed to avoid a confrontational relationship. There's a whole, I expect you've heard of it, this whole thing called the Thucydides trap, the idea that the rising power of the day and the established power of the day are inevitably going to essentially come clash. And so far now, for half a century, the United States and China have avoided that. So I actually think it's more than a classic balance of power. There's also a bit of mutual restraint and mutual self-interest about keeping open some paths for cooperation.
Well, since we engage in a lot of trade, between the two countries, especially the United States, depending on China, is the maker of many of our goods. But how does China's approach to international relations compare with ours?
Well, China's largely seen itself as a developing country. It hasn't taken on responsibilities for maintaining order regionally or globally. The real question is whether that's beginning to change. And you see China more involved in global climate talks, more helpful with North Korea. So I actually think one of the interesting developments going on in the world right now is China making something of a transition towards being a more established, responsible power.
On the other hand, in the South China Seas, China is showing a greater willingness to use military force.
Absolutely. It's acting unilaterally there, and that's an area we've got to push back. Now, whether we sail through it or fly over it, China has to understand that we're not going to tell them where the lines have to go. We're not going to draw borders, but China can't be in a position to redraw things unilaterally.
Well, how do we do that, considering the fact that the countries that China will be in conflict with are allies of the United States?
That's how we do it. We sail through it. We fly over. And China understands that, China still needs a stable and external environment. Why? Because it still needs to grow, and it grow at a fast pace. And political stability in China, which is what the leadership there cares more about than anything, still depends on relatively high rates of economic growth, relatively low rates of unemployment. I think that constrains China in ways that Russia, which is by no means integrated economically, China's constrained in much more fundamental ways.
The British Prime Minister Theresa May has called for an election, and France has its upcoming election. Where could still stronger nationalist movements lead?
Well, in Europe, they could lead to the breakup of both NATO and the European Union, and that's something we haven't seen now for three-quarters of a century. I think the more important than Brexit suddenly has become how the French decide to vote in the next couple of weeks.
Because that could destroy the EU.
Absolutely.
Now, then there's the referendum in Turkey this Sunday that granted President Erdogan nearly authoritarian powers. Our President Trump called to congratulate him. How is that being seen around the world?
I thought that was a big mistake. This is a referendum that essentially institutionalizes a degree of authoritarianism that ends any possibility of Turkish political integration in Europe. They should not have been congratulated, particularly given that we don't even know how to what extent it may have been rigged. Plus, the United States and Turkey now also have some big foreign policy differences about how we're going to deal with a situation in Syria. So I just didn't understand the reason for that call.
Well, although the president has capitalized on populist sentiment, he has business interests in Turkey, and some people are saying that's the reason. Isn't globalization continuing regardless of populist sentiments?
Well, a degree of globalization continues. For example, you know, global trade is still continuing, even though the United States took itself out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this new trade agreement that had been negotiated with a dozen countries representing, what, nearly half of the world's economy. But we are ourselves trying to reduce our involvement in the world, whether it is by cutting down the flows of immigrants and refugees, by shutting down certain trade flows. And the real other question is whether we are going to do enough to deal with those aspects of globalization that are malign, for example, what to do about climate change.
Well, let's talk about climate change. Do we have priorities here? It's been argued that as bad as a terrorist act may be, it will only affect one in many millions, while climate change will affect everyone on the planet.
Climate change is tough for democracies to deal with because they're slow acting. And they're diffuse in their effects. But it's real all the same. It doesn't have the drama that you just noted. But I think we're missing the boat. We're not doing enough there. Increasingly, you can do what you need to do on climate without slowing economic growth. So I think that trade-off has been shown increasingly not to be true. But I think we've actually reached a point where all these efforts probably won't work, and we're going to have to help individuals and countries adapt. And one day, we may have to, and I think we'll actually will have to get into the realm of science fiction. We're going to have to look at what's called a geoengineering, ways of reversing climate change by, say, putting in the atmosphere certain types of particles that reflect solar energy.
But that can't be done unilaterally.
One of the big questions will be whether to do something and how it's decided whether it's done.
Hasn't the Pentagon warned of possible security risks associated with climate change?
In my experience, admirals and generals are among the most moderate, reasonable people in the foreign policy debate because they often have to deal with the consequences of the breakdown of order.
So why do you think there are still so many politicians in this country who say that, who even deny that there is such a thing or deny that human activity has much to do with it?
It's become one of those symbolic issues that somehow, rather than debating it on the merits, it's become one of those issues that people almost use to define themselves, whether you're part of the elite or part of the establishment, whether you accept conventional wisdom or not. It's very hard to have a serious, fact-based, rigorous conversation about climate change with those who deny it.
Now, you mentioned Africa when you were talking about possible trouble spots. We usually mention the Middle East and the Korean Peninsula. Are Western nations paying too little attention to the countries of Africa?
I don't know if it's too little, but the kinds of problems in places like Africa are qualitatively different. It's not nuclear proliferation. It is, though, terrorism. In many cases, the problem is terrible governance. Say, in a country like South Sudan, you have a lot of weak states. You have massive numbers of people who are internally displaced or refugees. The fixes are very hard for outsiders to produce.
Your book came out before Donald Trump took office. How rapidly have things been developing since then?
Well, he's now been in office for nearly 100 days. We'll have that mark soon. And it's, I'd say essentially that all things equal, he, by what he said and done, has added to the disarray in the world that, ironically enough, he has to deal with.
You served in each of the past three Republican administrations. Have you advised anyone in the Trump administration?
Just for the record.
During the campaign?
To be clear, I also served in one Democratic administration. I served in Jimmy Carter's Pentagon, but I have worked for four presidents. I've talked to President Trump, both as a candidate and since as president, and I've talked to several members of his cabinet and several members of his White House staff.
So do you find certain foreign policy areas where the Trump administration would need to reassess its approach?
Well, they already did one reassessment, which was with China. If you remember early on, they introduced the idea of...
Over the best chocolate cake ever.
And I'm very upset you haven't served me any.
And well, I was concerned that the president then told an interviewer that he had sent those rockets into Iraq. I hope that we don't wind up attacking Iraq when we mean to attack Syria.
No, I think this administration has corrected itself to a large extent on China. It's not been in a position, interestingly enough, to pursue what I think would be an overly benign or even naive policy towards Russia. I think it moved away from a total hands-off policy in the Middle East to using the Tomahawks again after Syria used chemical weapons. So those are some examples where I think there's been some steps in the right direction. There's also, we already talked about areas I disagreed with, whether it's climate, the reaction to the Turkish elections. The opposition to the European Union, I think, has been really short-sighted.
In 2013, you wrote, "Foreign Policy Begins at Home, the Case for Putting America's House in Order." What sense of order did you have in mind regarding the United States then? And Does it apply today?
Alas, it applies at least as much, if not more. What I meant is we needed to put our economic house in order. We needed a deal, for example, with growing national debt. We needed a deal with infrastructure. We needed to deal with the fact that a lot of Americans are being left out of a successful life. More than anything, in order to do all those things, we needed to deal with our political dysfunction and what worries me.
The political division that we have.
Exactly. And what shows, it's not just the partisan division. Because now you have one party in control of the White House, the Senate, and the House, and you still can't get – you couldn't get health care reform through. And it looks like many of the economic reforms are going to be delayed.
There are also growing divisions within the U.S. economically and geographically.
Absolutely. I mean, books like Hillbilly Elegy and Coming Apart, I think, paint a fairly bleak picture. And, again, we alluded to it before. My real fear is things could get worse. I mean, what happens when we no longer have millions of jobs available for people who drive cars or trucks? How are those people to be employed? How are they to be tided over a transition? What kind of education and retraining are we going to make available that they have the basic educational skill set for? These are big issues, and unless we deal with these, how are we going to succeed as a country and have the resources and the focus to play a leading role in the world?
In a New York Times op-ed, Anthony Blinken, who was a deputy secretary of state under Obama, referred to President Trump's itchy Twitter finger. Do you have a sense of how the president is viewed abroad?
I have a pretty good sense. Most foreigners who come to see me ask me if I can help explain him. The rest of the world is flummoxed. This is, you know, Donald Trump is outside anything they've ever experienced before. And they constantly ask me for reading. How are they to understand this, whether it's the tweets, the public statements? I think also, to be blunt, they're unnerved. Foreigners, particularly those who base their security on American assurances, suddenly are saying, what can we count on anymore? We thought when we went to sleep at night, we could assume certain things. What Donald Trump has done, and I think it's awfully short-sighted, is he's taken away a degree of predictability. And he is something of a serial disruptor. I would like him to become more of a serial preserver.
Is there a concern that the president can undo the work of diplomats with a single off-the-cuff tweet or a public comment?
He can certainly make their work a lot more difficult. And he also has to be careful. By doing some of these things, he doesn't devalue the currency of his own word. What presidents say has great weight. He doesn't want the rest of the world to start saying, hey, I can discount this tweet, I can discount this statement, because the day will come, you know and I know, when he's going to need people around the world to take heed with every word that he articulates.
The Associated Press has called recent Trump administration policy reversals whiplash. What are the most notable changes in our foreign policy? Do you see them as a mixed bag? I mean, that's what I've been hearing from you during this conversation.
Yeah, I can't discern a pattern. All this talk about a Trump doctrine is silly. It's way premature. But yeah, we've seen major changes. The whiplash word has gotten a lot of usage recently, whether it's the closer relationship with China or the willingness to use force in the Middle East.
Is the president adopting a more unilateral approach to foreign policy? And can that work in the world of 1.0 or 2.0?
Unilateralism is a dead end. There's very little we can do in this world to deal with global issues. We don't have the resources to sustain a unilateral foreign policy. The American people won't buy it. Interestingly enough, this president, in many ways, ran against a unilateral foreign policy. He feels America's allies aren't sharing enough of the burden, but he hasn't figured out how to square his desire to act with his desire to get others to come on board.
Several people have described the reversals as a triumph of the Wall Street globalist faction of the administration. Would that signal greater attention to trade and the international economy?
I sure hope so. I've been called a globalist. I didn't realize until this administration that was a bad word. Anyhow, look, trade is strategically good for the United States. It supports our allies. It's a great tool for development. It's a great tool for economic growth. So I hope this administration revisits its views on trade.
Richard Haass's latest book is A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order. It is published by Penguin Press. And my great thanks to you and all your globalist ideas. Thanks for being on our show.
Thanks for having me.